So recently, I've been reading a lot of Félix Guattari, who, you know, of course, I've read in the past, mostly with Deleuze, but I've read Guattari on his own, but become quite enamored recently. He talks about machines, you know, and he and Deleuze both talk about machines quite a bit, which has me talking about machines, and I'm talking about the work of of this great artist who happens to be a friend of mine, and how his medium is the machine of art. I run into this issue which I run into all the time when I'm talking to somebody, especially somebody close to me, a friend or my special lady friend or my kid or anybody, and I start talking about this idea like a machine. I say I want to distinguish a machine from Foucault's discourse, from Althusser's ideology, from Marx's means of production. And I'm going on and on about what a machine is. And at some point, inevitably, there's this moment where my interlocutor, I use that term generously, as it's usually just me monologuing. So it's, you know, my cohort. Again, I use that word generously. You know, looks at me with a bit of a furrowed brow, you know, which they're trying to understand why the fuck I'm even talking about this at all. It comes up whenever I get enamored of an idea or a figure, you know, territorialization, deterritorialization. And it's something that will keep coming up in my exchanges with people. And at some point it's like, well, why? What does that do for you? What are you asking of me when I use these figures, territorialization, or in this case, a machine, machines, and I say all art, all images are elements within a machine. They're not products of a machine. They are elements within a machinic working that is a series of causes and effects and levers and modes of operation that include desire, right? Why this thing? Why do I take a picture of this? Why do I think this is something I can post to the technology, the idea of posting, the idea of this environment, to the economics of it? Who's making money in what ways? How is this economically valued? To the identity politics. What does posting this image say about me? How does it situate me vis-a-vis the social? How does it contribute or inflect my self-understanding and my desire vis-a-vis the social? What does this image mean, right? What is its whole sort of semiotic value, its significance? What is the goal, or what is my goal, which inevitably will differ from the image? But all of these things work in conjunction, right? It's not just like, oh, I have a great image I would love to post. I wish there were a technology. Well, no, the technology created the very notion of a post, right? And began to set the terms of what counts as something to post, right? And that exceeds the particular rules, let's say, of Instagram, right? No nipples or penises or vaginas or whatever, right? Those are the clear, obvious prohibitions that show that any technology is already enmeshed in a whole other series of discourses and laws and understandings and mores. But, you know, the very notion of posting an image comes from a technology, but the technology comes from a desire to post images, right? They're enmeshed in an economy of finance, an economy of desire, an economy of technology. And all those things work together to create a machine. And so the question is, well, so what, Coffee? You say images are produced as constitutive of a machine, which is to say a machine This machine doesn't work to create an image. That post on Instagram is not the end point. We're not all working towards that. That posting sets in motion or triggers or is distributed along a whole series of flows. Economic, right? The way Facebook owns Instagram, capitalizes financially, the way after you're posting it, the way the asks of your followers and your community, the likes, the shares, the not likes, the comments, the way it situates you and your various role in different communities, you know, whether it's a picture of your kid or some super arty thing or a picture of a band or whatever it is, it's situating you somewhere, which is to say this machine and the machines in general we're not using it in the capitalist sense of they're the means of production towards an end. The end is just another, there is no end. An end point, the production, is just another figure within the machine. So the machine of goods, let's say, somebody making tchotchkes like paperclips. The end point is not just the paperclip, right? But, you know, the money that flows from that, all the various uses of that, the way you feel about yourself for having made or bought or used a paperclip. So I'm explaining a little bit what I mean by a machine, but what I really want to talk about is why am I talking about machines? Why am I making this argument that images emerge as constituents of a machine that exceed them and creates the conditions of their production and their consumption, their dissemination, their value in the social and economic economies. Why a machine? Why am I talking about this at all? Well, you know, I think it's a question that only ever arises at a moment of discomfort, at a moment of sort of alienation from concepts. Because the fact is, we deploy concepts all the time. We're taught concepts and we deploy them all the time. An explicit one would be something like the unconscious, right? We have an unconscious or subconscious, and we have an ego. Those are concepts, right? We now take them for granted as things that are just part of the world. It's just true. But the fact is, those were created. Those were concepts that were put forth, and then were taught, and at some point you decided made sense. Maybe not even true. So I want to say that what a concept is a distribution of bodies. A concept is a little machine. Concept is a way, it's literally an engine that distributes certain kinds of elements or bodies in such a way and puts them in a certain relationship to each other. A machine says, well, there are, to say that images are produced or are elements within a machining production is to say that this is complicated, right? So talk about a machine and say images are part of machines is to already shift our understanding and ask you that when you look at an image, to not just see it as something you just take for granted and then just judge and assess already within the terms of that machine. I'm saying that the very ways we interact with images, the very production of them, their creation, their sharing, the way we judge and assess them, the way we hang them on our walls or don't, or look at them in books or on billboards, on our phones, is part of something that exceeds that moment, right? That very moment that we take for granted of saying, oh, look, there's a picture of my kid. There's a picture of Kaya's kid. Oh, great. Look, Amelia looks fantastic. That's That happens all the time, and that's not a good or bad thing. That's just something that happens. But when I say that it's a machine and that that is an element within a machine, what I'm asking is that next time you look at that image, you see it as a moment within a set of all kinds of flows. Flows that led up to it, the flows of the various ways it is used and understood, and you know, it's sort of terms of distribution, technologically, financially, affectively, emotionally. A concept is this little engine. It's a little engine. It takes up this thing, takes up this image, the act of you looking at it, and pieces together various things. It's asking you to bring into play a certain financial understanding. It's asking you not to take for granted the terms of its production, but to actually say, oh, this came from somewhere. This was something that was made. The mere fact that I say it's a machine, this mere act, right? It becomes a kind of performative, right? An action in which I say, oh, machines are produced as elements within a machine. The very way now you look at machine, you look at images, look at machine, sure. The very way you look at an image, I hope, is then reconfigured or configured other than perhaps you were looking at it before. And I'm asking you to situate it a certain way. For instance, I say an image emerges as an expression of your subconscious. Okay. Then when you look at an image, you're looking at it in terms of a relationship to the creator's subconscious. And you're wondering, well, okay, I already know what a subconscious is. So a concept involves other concepts, such as the concept of the subconscious. And you're seeing a certain relationship between these things. Oh, because these things happened, because these things are in that person's head and in their experience, this image emerged, right? To say that an image is an element that emerges from a subconscious is a concept that configures the relationship between that image's value, its significance, and the terms of its production. If I say an image is constitutive, an element within a machine, it does something different than a subconscious, right? I'm asking you to think differently than saying it's an element of subconscious, or an image is just a product of beauty. Beauty summons it. Beauty is an all-knowing thing. It's eternal, and images are grasping towards eternal beauty. That would be another concept that's asking you to, it's not even asking you, it is configuring the relationships between that image, certain concepts, certain ways you should be viewing its success or failure, the terms of its production. Well, this is what concepts do, right? They fold the world together, right? They, again, like a little machine, they create a relationship between parts, right? You have an ego. Ego is a concept. Well, I don't have to have an ego, right? There weren't always egos. Ego is something that was created as a concept. And now we think about people as having this ego, and the ego is some kind of idealized version of themselves or a will to their narcissism or their selfishness that inflects their thinking, and then it gets either valorized as, you know, in people like Ayn Rand, or demonized in people like the Buddha, and, this very creation of this concept asks us to see the world a certain way, right? One way I've thought about concepts is, you say, yes, it's this engine, but I almost see it as a cinema engine, because it works over the world you're seeing, much in the way cinema does, or dreams. Dreams and cinema are closely related, as David Lynch has taught me, right? They both work over the world we experience, right? They make something else of it and create new experiences. They are themselves little engines that rework the everyday to make something new. And in many ways, that's what a concept is. You hear a concept, the machine, or territorialization, or Foucault's discourse, or Derrida's difference, you know, or Descartes' cogito, you know, I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am. You know, Descartes' famous proclamation to refute skepticism, right? And that's a, you know, skepticism is on the rise in this sort of pre-Enlightenment era, and you know, this sort of radical doubting of everything. And Descartes says, okay, I'll buy that. Let me see. I'll doubt everything. He puts himself alone in a room, which is already part of the concept. And he says, I'm going to shut myself off from everything, and I'm going to doubt everything. How do I know anything? How do I know that these are my hands, that I exist, that I... He starts sort of doubting everything and realizing, yeah, sure, you can doubt everything. And then he has this moment and he says, well, within this doubting, I realize that I'm still thinking. The only thing I can't doubt is that I am doubting, which is thinking. And he says, well, therefore I am, right? That thinking is this one thing that can't be refuted within the very act of doubting. Now, that emerges itself as part of an elaborate machine of things he's considering and not considering. But the point is, the cogito, this concept of thinking as the grounds of being, I think, therefore I am, situates a relationship between thinking, being, and identity. Right? Which is very different than Foucault coming along and saying, well, identity emerges as this construct within as part of a discursive, social, historically specific understanding, that there is no being or identity outside of its local historical construction. Two concepts, the cogito, Foucault's discourse, that ask us to see and slice up our identities and put our identity in relationship to the rest of the world in these very different ways. That's what a concept asks of us, right? So when you hear a concept that's strange, like Deleuze and Guattari's territorialization, or deterritorialization, reterritorialization, you think, well, okay, well, so fucking what? What do you want me to do with that? What it's asking you to do is see differently, is to go with it, as if it's sort of an avant-garde film, recasting the world, right? That's what a concept does. It slices up the world and puts terms of relationships between them. Art does the same thing. It's concepts aren't the only thing that distribute the world. That's what writing does. That's what art does, right? I mean, Francis Bacon's distribution of the body and its relationship to the social radically configured in his drawings, right? And this sort of, the body is this endlessly sort of smearing, flesh falling off the bone, always in these areas of eventum, right? It's never in the social. He doesn't draw groups of people and the body falling off. It's always this isolated thing in a chair, on a table, a circle drawn around it. It's this sort of privileging of this event of the deterritorialization of the human body. The world is constantly being sliced and diced. This is what we do. Often, 99.9% of the time, we take for granted that I have an ego, that I am a man and you are a woman, that's my TV and this is a house, and all these are figures or concepts that we just take for granted, but they configure the world in a certain way, so that we don't see them anymore. So when you hear a strange concept, such as machines, here's Coffeen talking about the art machine, the image machine, what's he talking about? Well, what I'm asking is for you to re-see, to literally see the world differently, right? To recast the distribution and relationship between elements, and see what comes of it, right? So that's the next question, really. So Kaufman, you're asking us to just see the world differently, see the world in image production as an element within a machine. Okay, I can see that, but what does that do for us? So that's the next move, right? So the first move is to say, well, a strange idea that you hear is really just asking you to, you're always working with ideas and concepts. A new one is asking you to do it differently, right? So it's sort of this sort of alien, this moment of alienation, where the very things and the habits and of your behavior and your thinking are taken for granted and now become sort of exposed because you're introduced to another idea. So there's simply that element. But then there's how do we assess that? Like, why do I believe in the ego or not? Why do I say, yes, the world is machinic or not? What do you want from us, Coffee? And what do you want from me in talking about this? What will it do for me? And that's really a beautiful question, which itself is quite radical. It's really Nietzsche's question, which is that concepts and ideas, philosophy, writing, it's not about getting a truth. It's not about saying, oh, now I know something. Rather, it's a question of the experiences it affords and forges. So rather than saying, is this true or not, which is a false question, or is a question that's already part of a certain machine, right? So myself, I'm a rhetorician, right? I'm a sophist. I never ask if something's true or not, right? That doesn't interest me, you know, except perhaps someone tells me it's raining. I say, is that true? Is it raining? And so it's not that there's some value there, but for the most part, it's not what guides me. It's not a term within my apparatus of making sense, right? What interests me is, well, okay, I hear an idea, and it can do certain things for me. And one thing it can do is it can bring me pleasure. I can like thinking something. I can say, well, that's an insane idea. I don't think it has any bearing on reality, but I enjoy thinking it. That's fantastic, right? That's fantastic. Reading philosophy, it's often the case, right? I mean, I studied philosophy and I read a lot of Hegel in my dissertation. My PhD exams, one of my fields was on Hegel. I actually did that with Judith Butler, Hegel and Kierkegaard. Judith Butler on my committee, she's a Hegelian scholar. I'm reading Hegel and reading the phenomenology of spirit and philosophy of mind and reading all of it. And I'm thinking, huh, there's no way this shit sits with me, right? There's a nuttiness about it all. And I'm just, it's not my worldview, but it is a worldview. And so reading Hegel, I didn't have to say, well, no, Hegel, you're wrong, because I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit if he's right or wrong, right? I'll deploy him or not deploy him in various ways, and I never really deployed Hegel because it didn't sit with me. It's not a mode of going. It's not a dance move that fits with my body. But it is a conceptual engine that I enjoyed. Viewing and considering and taking on and seeing the world as such, you know. And then I read Kant, and it was the same thing, you know. I pulled more from Kant probably than from Hegel, but for the most part, Kant's totally for Kant, right? He's a rationalist. He's a lunatic, which rather than me saying, well, that's just not true, fuck Kant, I was like, oh my God, this is elaborate sculptural machinic operation, right? right? The way moves he has to make to justify morality or justify aesthetic judgment are so complex and so beautiful and so convoluted. There's simply a pleasure in a concept, a pleasure in seeing the world as such, seeing it distributed as such. And for me, it's always a great delight in philosophy. It's these sort of proliferation of possible worlds. Rather than truth seeking, right? When I read philosophy, I'm not seeking truth. I'm not saying, oh, this guy's right, this guy's wrong, this guy's half right. I didn't have a goal or an endpoint or a destination. You know, each philosopher offered for me another movie, another way of slicing and dicing it all. You know, and I might take a lick here and there. I might say, well, you know, I'm not a big, I'm not a big Michael Bay fan, right? But Michael Bay has some great shots. And, you know, I'm making my movie. I might take a couple. Doesn't mean I'm into the whole Michael Bay worldview. But I like some of his licks, right? Same with a philosopher, you know. Kant's relentless rationalism is insane, but it leads to a kind of delirium I enjoy. And then there are certain figures that I just like, you know, his notion of beautiful and sublime. And I got a lot of mileage out of those, taught the shit out of those. They still sit with me. Kant's notion of the beautiful gave me this idea that became my domain name, my URL, and a concept that figured prominently in my life. And it's actually the name of my incorporated business, right? Is joyful complexity, this notion of a bounded infinity. You know, I got from Kant's beautiful to, you know, Leibniz's calculus, you know, to Deleuze's fold. You know, I wove those together. So there's a pleasure. The point is this, there's simply an aesthetic pleasure. And I don't mean to belittle that. There's something quite profound and resonant about such a thing. But there's also, of course, material implications and repercussions outside of my aesthetic enjoyment. So if we look at the figure of a machine, I think part of the problem I have with talking to people about this or that in the political realm or the sort of shared social realm is that I do see things as machinic, as part of what we call systems thinking. And so, you know, here's an example. You know, I'm actually reading an article in The New Yorker about the BBC and the gender equality in payment to the BBC, which became a big issue I didn't know about until I read this New Yorker article. But you could pass a law that says, well, you have to pay anybody for the same job, the same pay, whether a man, a woman, or we can begin to exceed those two, that binary distinction, but just, you know, equal pay for equal work. But your job's not done then, right? The machine, the system that creates and allows for that has an element of this sort of disparate pay exceeds the law, right? I mean, for fuck's sake, we all know that, right? Right. So to ever just think the public policy or the political realm, what we call the political realm, is the sort of arena for change, right? They're grossly mistaken, right? I mean, the law is one element within an elaborate machine. That has, according to this article, you know, claiming that, you know, one reason that counts for certain discrepancies is, you know, women already often believe that they shouldn't apply for certain jobs, right? We know this is a big issue here in the Bay Area and in the world of around coders and developers, technology developers, but there are not a lot of women. And part of that is women not being hired. But it's also women not desiring going into coding, right? So there's a desiring machine that's distinct yet related to this legislative machine, right? And then there's the perceptive machine of how we view men and women and what it means to code. And is that masculine or feminine? Is that even something that should be gendered, right? So you immediately see that something as seemingly simple as, well, equal pay for equal work, is enmeshed in a series of levers and pulleys that speak to desire and biology and libido and perception and semiotic value and economic value, and they're all intertwined. From that perspective, thinking about the machine and thinking about machines shifts, for me, hopefully would shift how one would even go about or even consider and contemplate social change. In this sense, concepts, they enable, they, by redistributing and slicing up the world and distributing them in such a way and shifting our very way of going with them, they inflect behavior, they inspire behavior, they are a kind of behavior that then enact other bodies in motion, right? They can put you to work. So in particular, the figure of the machine and thinking in terms of machines, thinking in terms of the machines as to, when I look out over the world, when I see the workplace and traffic systems and the sort of toils and tribulations of my life and what I see as life in general, and then when I see the machines in which I am embroiled and an actor, and when I suddenly stop taking an action for granted and see it as constitutive of a series of operations, as a kind of, within a system or a machinic production of identity, of gender, of fatherhood, of, a human being, just how I make sense. There's a kind of exhilaration. It's not just that it's revelatory and go, aha, now I understand. What it does is displace the calm, I'll say, the calm or the calm of everyday life, of habit, right? Of just the things we take for granted as just true or natural, right? What the machine does is include the natural within its mode of understanding, right? So there is no natural. The machine doesn't sit on top of the natural. So my biology, is not distinct from the machine. The machine doesn't come in after my body. Machines are systems, or the way we think about solar systems and cosmic systems and galaxies and ecosystems, right? I mean, it's in a way that's what I'm talking about, are ecosystems. What I like about machines is there's a series of levers, right? But ecosystem is a related notion. And by always situating and always deploying this concept or having it at work, right? It's not deployed as much as it's metabolized. And as much as it metabolizes and is in turn metabolized, my very way of going in the world becomes fluid, right? Becomes kind of ungrounded. And this has been my attraction really to rhetoric, and it's been a drive of mine really since I was a kid. It's a will to unground the things I take for granted, and the things mostly other people take for granted, right? I really came up with that sort of driver, is that I found any sort of groupthink or any inherited dogma inherently suspect. And I just, a lot of that comes from my ego, from a certain ego machine, right, within the social. And that I just, you know, didn't have time for that crap. I just always wanted to poke any school or my parents or any sort of dogma was handed down to me. I love to poke at and always weasel away from and find my own position. And I'm going to talk about that soon and different notions of community. Community of like-minded people freaks my shit, man. But my point is, for me, the figure of the machine and of machinic participation, machinic construction, is that there is nothing outside the machine, right? I'm always situating everything at the point of its ability to always be taken up in a different machine and be not co-opted, but deployed, configured in a different distribution of the world. So imagine that every construct, right, a construct of gender, again, all the constructs of identity, right? So gender, right, for me, a father, a son, a boyfriend, a lover, a friend, a fuck buddy, all the various kinds of relationships we can have with people, a mentor, a teacher, a boss, a client, a consultant, all these relationships, right? We come to them and there are certain expectations and then of behavior that come to us from various ways, you know, least of all from the law, right? The law is probably the least active institution in our cultural reproduction and how we sort of culturally propel ourselves. But always situating oneself, for me, always situating myself at the juncture at which everything being posited, including the things I'm saying, at the point of their own collapse, at the point of their just another figure, as a point at which they are not inherently good or true or right. They're just a way of going, and they're the way of going that's being used right now, and I will assess them in all kinds of various ways, but it's always risking its own collapse, right? So to always situate yourself within machines and seeing the entire world from the cellular and the atomic to the cosmic to the emotional, the affective, and the social as all embroiled and configured within certain machinic terms of production is to always have the world at its limit of dissolution or of recasting. Not really dissolution, but recasting. Always can be refigured differently. And inevitably this makes for all kinds of problems, for me in the social. And again, this is something I'm going to talk about soon in another podcast because it's a big topic, right? And what happens when you're trying to negotiate the social, but your very terms of going with the social are such that all the mores and terms are up for grabs, right? Practically speaking, what it's meant for me is I've relied a lot on irony and humor, and as a result, have enjoyed, a pretty pervasive alienation from the world. Also, successes. I found a place. I've done things, and I continue to do things. I don't really get invited to parties, but the posturing or the proffering of this concept, this figure, the machine, as a way of as a concept which understands and sees and explains and distributes the world is itself a strange concept because it itself can always be taken up and redistributed differently, right? And this is really the retort's conundrum or the retort's pleasure. I used to always say when I had opened my rhetoric classes is rhetoric is the position of all positions, including the position that says all positions are ridiculous, right? it's the position of all positions, including the position that negates the position of all positions. And that's just a logically impossible place, but practically is quite a vibrant place and quite an exhilarating place for me. And that's why I talk about machines. That's why I talk about machines. It gives me pleasure, and there's an aesthetic delight, and I can say that there's I could lean into a machine, a conceptual discourse, freedom from discursive hegemonies, but I don't really know what freedom is, to be honest. It's one of those things that's always really, really confused me. And so I don't go there. But I'll say that, again, freedom is not a figure I use often as a way to explain or understand myself. But delight and pleasure, and I suppose a freedom to configure as I will. So yeah, a liberty or license to deploy the world, rethink the world, is certainly something I resort to and count on. So why a machine? Why any concept? Because concepts are like art, but so much more, but potentially so much more powerful or pervasive or insidious, in that they, you can see a Van Gogh and then see those sort of swirly skies and sunflowers everywhere. And that can happen, and that does happen to some degree, but take a concept like the ego, and all of a sudden you're reading the entire world, your very understanding, your whole affective economy, your relationships with your family and lovers and yourself before the divine or the sublime, or a concept is like a really pervasive artist when it really sneaks up in there. And so for now, I'm taking on this machine. I'm taking on machinic thinking, systems thinking. And I don't want to call it systems thinking, but I need to think about that some more. But to take it up is to really have a kind of relentless, radical reorienting. Man, that's why a machine.